You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Monday, 13 April. We've got U.S. existing home sale data due 4 p.m. our time. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Nkunzi Sanlam, Private Wealth. Failed peace talks, although, I mean, things are complicated, but maybe the market is just adjusting to it. Tough U.S. March inflation, no surprises there. And earnings season is kicking off. Chatting with Keith McClellan, stock-based compensation, the good, the bad, and truthfully, the very ugly. And then we'll be chatting with Standard Charter. Dramatic prices, 100 plus oil. Is it as bad as it used to be? Perhaps no, because of less severe energy intensity. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb, crippled smelter operators secure tariff lifeline from Eskom, deal now in the hands of the regulator NERSA. And business day, diesel surge pushes freight firms towards the brink of closure. Full price shocks threaten closures in South Africa's freight sector. Morning markets, US was red on mixed. S&P was down 0.1% and Nasdaq up 0.1%. In the east, it's all red. Sydney 1.2% down, Tokyo 1% off, Hong Kong 1.3% down, and Tencent just over 3% off. Commodities mostly red. Gold futures, 4,742. Brent the green at $102.26. Platinum red, 2,045. Palladium red, 1,543. The rand is 1,655. Bitcoin, 70,900. And top 40 opening call, a red open, 1,600 points, almost 1.5% lower.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Nkunzi Sanlam, Private Wealth. Nick, appreciate the early Monday morning. Peace talks in Pakistan over the weekend, 21 hours, didn't yield any peace. To put it in, I suppose, some sort of sense, I mean, it took Obama 4 years to negotiate with Iran. Trump now threatening blockade, although technically the peace, the two-week abatement is holding. I don't know. You said before we came on air, and I got to agree with you. I thought markets would perhaps respond worse. Maybe we're starting to get to the point of where we're kind of immune to this, notwithstanding the implications.
Yeah, morning, Simon. I think you're spot on, as you said. We had a chat, and I purposely didn't want to look at the markets. Yes, I thought I'm not going to ruin my Sunday. I was expecting big moves. A couple of assets have moved quite a bit, but definitely not as bad as I thought. And I mean, S&P futures now, I mean, what is it, 3-4% of its all-time high? It's hardly really even moved. So yeah. I don't know, maybe a little bit of war fatigue. Maybe we're getting a bit immune to the Trump tweet, who knows? But a little bit more of a subdued but negative open section for today.
And certainly we saw some data coming through on Friday. U.S. inflation for March was 3.3. April sentiment index fell to 47.6. I mean, none of these are frankly surprises. They're not great numbers, but I mean, all things considered, gasoline prices and the like, these are not surprises for the data we're seeing.
Not surprises. And I think this is probably more of the story to concentrate on, because the longer this war drags on, the more inflation is going to become entrenched. And this is the first sort of print that you've seen the results of that consumer price index, 3.3 in March. That is actually the highest level since May 2024. If you think just a year ago, that was under 2.5. So these are the headline numbers you should be aware of. And again, week number 7, the longer this drags on for these inflation prints are going to become more and more concerning against the backdrop of something else to look forward to. Simon, we've got U.S. earnings season starting this week too, so maybe detract from just the war talk for now.
Well, that's just it. Earnings season kicking off with Goldman Sachs before market open today. And then tomorrow's JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Citi, BlackRock, and to throw in there Johnson & Johnson. I mean, earnings season just seems to always be coming fast and furious, but we are going to start seeing numbers. And for me, the big question is going to be perhaps guidance, if companies are confident enough to do it.
Yeah, listen, the sort of, as they call it, the whisper numbers that are doing the rounds now, these banks should knock it out the park. I mean, they love volatility. Their trading desks thrive on it. There's been more than enough of that. So I suspect we'll see record numbers up. But yeah, pivot and fast forward a little bit. Those forward guidance are going to be important. And also, I'm also quite interested to see there's been a lot of chat about the private credit space and the private equity space. I want to see what the banks have to say about that. JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon talking about the cockroaches in the room. So a few things to also keep an eye on there as well. But earnings season should, I would assume, be half decent this week anyway.
Because it'll be to end of March, so of course it has the March month in it. And as you say, the banks are going to be likely knocking it out the park. We leave it there. Nick Kunze, Sanlam Private Wealth. Appreciate the early morning time. Give your money the return at once without taking a flight with the StanLib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Keith McLachlan. You find him, of course, at Element Investment Managers. Keith, appreciate the early morning time. Stock-based compensation, a fancy way of saying that sometimes, usually executives are paid maybe bonuses, maybe signing bonuses, etc., in shares rather than cash. At a high level, I don't particularly have a problem with it. And in fact, it does kind of align incentives. And I know you and I have talked often around, you know, find the incentives.
Good morning, Simon. The short answer is yes. It's trying to deal with something called the agent principal problem, where the people managing these large listed businesses very rarely are the owners, i.e. the shareholders of these large listed businesses. So you're trying to align incentives, but like anything in finance, taken to the extreme, it can get abused. And share-based compensation, in many instances, where and this is especially prevalent in the technology sector out of Silicon Valley, if you have a look at share-based compensation as a percentage of revenue, the Nasdaq is trading at about 3 times the S&P 500 as a percentage. And in some instances, these businesses are actually just listed remuneration schemes looking for shareholders, where the shareholders get none of the economic benefits. So, like I said, good on paper, but taken to the extreme, it can be deeply abused.
And some of those are extreme. I mean, I pulled some numbers. I mean, Meta, and to be clear, I mean, Meta's not a startup by any stretch. You know, percentage of revenue over the last 12 months on shareback stock base is a 10%. I mean, it is a giant number. Now, Palantir, 15, and then Costco, 0.31. It is the number that's important. The Costco number seems fine. The Meta number seems a little bit crazy, frankly.
Sure. I mean, The worst culprit of this is Snowflake, and CrowdStrike is number two. Snowflake, 40% of their revenue goes into share-based compensation. You know, CrowdStrike averages about 20-25% of the last couple of years. And then there's Zscaler and Palantir and so on and so forth. But if you stand back, what is the problem with this? And if someone is earning a benefit, And the reason that share-based compensation is because the employees are getting it, then someone is paying it. Mm-hmm. But these companies turn around and they go, we need to exclude share-based compensation from profits, and look how wonderfully profitable we are. Look how wonderfully cash generative we are. But you can't do that. That's not actually really an authentic representation of the economics in the business. So there's a lot of obfuscation of the numbers. I mean, just to give you another sense, share-based compensation, and it's one thing to remove it from a US GAAP or IFRS accounting statement and go, our adjusted profits are this. They're not really, but then they turn around and they also go, our free cash flow is this. And this is where some of the subtlety appears, where share-based compensation is non-cash based because you're giving shares instead of cash. And therefore, your free cash flow is flattered. But in fact, if you have a look at what you touched on, these companies tend to have systemic share buybacks to try to offset the dilution. And a share buyback is actually slotted into the capital part of the free cash listed, or the cash flow statement. So you've actually got to go, well, this is not actually an authentic buyback. It's just structured in such a way to offset the share-based compensation, and we have to take that out of free cash flow as well. And suddenly these free cash flow empires that these businesses are proud of collapse, and they generate a lot less than they appear to.
And that's just it. It fundamentally fudges the numbers, and fudges is in some cases actually just a polite phrase there. And if we look at the whole point, I mean, that they're out there, they're buying back the shares, they then give those shares essentially to executives. I mean, this is a cost to the business that is often not seen, and it is. I mean, to me, it frankly just feels deeply, deeply dodgy. You know, why not just, you know, be honest with it and, I don't know, give cash and let them go and buy shares? We know why, because that's harder to sort of work through the system.
Well, a short answer, share-based compensation is just the fancy extension of your payroll. That's it.
Yeah.
If you were to turn around and go, right, we're cutting all our share-based compensation, the employees would turn around and go, right, you have to pay us more in cash. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. It's one way or the other. And you can see companies like Salesforce and Palantir that are trying to pull back their share-based compensation, go have a look at their payroll, and it's escalating faster and faster as well. So this is a very, very real cost to the business. The argument can be that you're aligning interest, and these are often typically in businesses with large human capital pools. Mm-hmm. So you want to retain your good employees and incentivize them. But like I said right at the beginning, it's being abused. About any good idea in finance taken to the extreme, it's been abused, and all the PR and spin from management doesn't make this not a real cost. If someone is earning it, then someone is paying it. And in this case, shareholders are paying it.
So in essence, the challenge here really is around disclosure. That they're just a good old fashioned, you know, don't fudge it, don't hide it, just actually disclose it. Put it on the compensation line. We don't mind paying people.
Absolutely. And that's also where the obfuscation comes from. All these adjusted earnings figures, stripping it out, it's a very, very real cost. And at the same time, let's be honest about what those share buybacks are. They're just there trying to offset the dilution from issuing shares. So in fact, that's actually an OPEX item. Mm-hmm. It's not a true buyback, and stick those into the free cash flow as well. But of course, management will typically in the listed environment give you the best possible story. And that's where this abuse starts to appear.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that almost is in there. That's part of their contract in many cases. Quick last question. We then have all these shares out there, and I asked Chantal Marks this question last week. Your view on director dealings. I mean, if we're doing share-based compensation and stock-based, and let's assume that this is legitimate and not, you know, let's say it's a Costco, which is a 0.31, management are ultimately then going to be net sellers, and maybe we should stress less when management are selling.
So I put director dealings into three buckets. Mm-hmm. Directors sell shares for many, many, mm-hmm. many different reasons. Not because they're overvalued. Sometimes they just need a holiday, or daughter's gotten married and got to pay for a wedding. Or you can sell shares for 1,000 different reasons. Then there's director dealings that are linked to effectively the share-based compensation. Mm-hmm. Those are almost mechanical. You know, you'll notice as options mature, they'll buy, then sell to pay the tax. You almost exclude those ones that's part of the payroll that's just coming out in sins and is coming out post-fact. And then you get guys that are walking into the market buying significant chunks of shares with cash. Now, there's only one reason you're buying a share in a market of using your own cash. And this is beyond payroll, beyond mm-hmm. anything else. You see value in it, and you're going to generate a return. Those ones are significant, especially if the person is an insider who already owns a material amount.
Yeah, exactly what Chantal said. The buys, that's what really matters. Keith McLachlan, Element Investment Managers, appreciate the early morning time. Our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter, your view on issuing shares to staff. I mean, stock-based compensation can be done right, can be done wrong. Have your vote, have your say. Give your money smoother returns with StanLib Asset Management. The StanLib Flexible Income Fund's agile investment process preserves and grows capital in all markets.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Manpreet Gill, CIO for Africa, Middle East and Europe at Standard Chartered Wealth Solutions. Manpreet, appreciate the early morning time. Obviously, oil at 100, above 100 as we speak. Lots of sort of looking back to the 70s and stagflation narrative. You're pushing back on that narrative, saying $100 oil today, less dangerous than it was 50 years ago. What's your thinking and reasoning here?
Hi, morning. No, I think it's a key point here, because I think we're seeing a lot of doom and gloom headlines. And yeah, and it's not that we're seeking to downplay the risks here. But I think it's important to recall that, you know, $100 today is very different from $100 in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
One, because of inflation, but also because you need, you know, significantly less than half, you know, the amount of oil you needed per unit of GDP, per unit of economic output, compared to the 1970s. The world has gotten a lot more efficient. So this is, you know, high oil prices, but, you know, it's not having the same economic shock or inflationary shock as we did, you know, 4 or 5 decades ago. And I think that has helped to some degree, and I think helps explain why markets, you know, are relatively holding up in many parts, much more at least than one would have otherwise expected.
Yeah, it's a great point. Inflation and efficiencies both kind of kick in to make it less scary. S&P Global saying we'd need 150, maybe even a 200 barrel price for oil to sort of replicate those 70s shocks. I mean, are we at risk of getting there? And I appreciate this is a situation in deep flux at the moment, but from your sense, and are we at risk of that?
So I think this is where scenario-based thinking can really help.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, that type of outcome on oil prices, I think you'd need quite a bad scenario for that to occur. And of course, like you said, we're in flux, so you can't rule anything out at this point. So while it's not a base case, you'd most probably need much more Middle East oil output just taken off the table. I don't think we've got there because, you know, across the Gulf, for example, we've seen quite a bit of, you know, output redirected,
mm-hmm.
You know, which has brought, obviously not all, but I think treatment percentage output back, you know, to the, you know, east-west pipeline, for example, in Saudi.
Yeah.
So that has helped mitigate the effect. I think to get to that level of shock, you need, you know, a scenario where, you know, most, if not all, of the output from the region is really suspended. And we don't think, you know, we'll get to that sort of scenario, but
mm-hmm.
but actually, like you said, it's a situation in flux and something we assess day to day.
Yeah, I was reading reports on the weekend that Saudi East-West pipeline is getting up to its full capacity of 7 million barrels a day. That takes a lot of pain out of the scenario. In terms of where then for the investor, you're recommending inflation-linked bonds, you're liking energy stocks, and you're liking gold as the hedge. I mean, all three making perfect sense in this environment for where we sit. And again, something that is in flux, and we have no idea how long it will take to play out.
Yes, and I think what we're really trying to achieve here, big picture, is that the advantage of holding hedges like that is it allows investors to leave their long-term allocations unchanged. Because, you know, while we're discussing some of the downside risks, the reality is there is an upside case where, you know, equity markets do okay and this, you know, crisis resolves sooner than at least what a lot of people expect at this point in time. So I think when it comes to the hedges, though, they all serve a slightly different purpose. I think inflation-protected bonds have already performed to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're really trying to directly hedge against inflationary risk. The energy sector equity is really just trying to look for assets that are correlated to oil prices, because that's clearly where the risk is.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be careful about positioning, because a lot of investors have had the same idea. But if you see that unwind at any point, that's something we'd be happy to consider. And gold is a bit more long-term, because obviously it doesn't help quite as much in the short term against the rising oil prices. But if you worry about some of the scenarios we discussed, you know, super high oil prices, creating stagflation, much worse than what we expect in our base case scenario at least, that's where gold can really play, you know, a key role. And it's an asset class we like for a lot of other reasons, these more optimistic scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, gold's been a good hold for some years now. A last question. Asian equities is your contrarian call. What's the trigger that you would look for? I get the sense here that sort of, is it a sort of an agreement of peace? What's the trigger you're looking for the Asian equity call?
I guess the key trigger here is oil prices, because it's sort of the opposite to the hedges. That look, if we're right in our base case that, you know, we do get some resolution at least to the oil price question and the output, then Asia as a region is the most sensitive of the major regions to oil prices, macroeconomically, but also from an equity market perspective. That explains why we've seen some of the underperformance in the past 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. But if we do move towards a resolution, then that's obviously where one would expect to see the most upside from these sort of entry points. So it is a little bit contrarian, but I think it's really playing to saying, yes, we know what we'd hedge, what hedges put in place for against downside scenarios. But in that upside scenario, what's likely to perform the best? And I think Asian equities, for a variety of different earnings reasons as well, but actually right against oil prices, we think that can be an interesting trigger.
We'll leave it there. It's been Preet Gill, CIO, Africa, Middle East, Europe for Standard Chartered Wealth Solutions. Appreciate the early morning. That's it for today. We're chatting with Metete Tulari on Friday. He's from Investec. Talking US GDP and the PCE inflation data. GDP weak, PCE is preferred by the Fed and wasn't a great number either. We asked what you made of the numbers. Consensus was it was poor, very poor. This podcast is brought to you by StanLib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie Nobuchle, Nicole Sabu, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Property stocks in March.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now. On the money.